Welcome back to Science and Society. I'm Dr. David Lindberg with my co-host,
Sam Kephart.
Our next guest is Dr. George Becky, Gordon Marshall Professor of Computer Science, Electrical Engineering, and Biomedical Engineering at USC. Dr. Becky's research interests are in the areas of cooperative, intelligent, multiple robotic systems and applications of AI and robotics to medicine. Dr. Becky has published over 200 technical papers in the areas of robotics, computer simulation, and human-machine systems. He is co-editor of several books, including Autonomous Underwater Robotic Systems and Robot Colonies. Dr. Becky is editor-in-chief of the journal Autonomous Robots and founding editor of the IEEE Transactions on Robotics and Automation. Please welcome Dr. George Becky. George, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And certainly you honor us by making time to appear on the show. George, there's been a great deal of interest lately in robotics, and certainly over the last 2 years with the wonderful success of Mars Spirit and Opportunity. Can you give us a brief overview and really talk about the progress that we've had in the last 10 years?
Sure, I'd be glad to. In some ways, the progress has been spectacular, and in other ways, it appears to be creeping along.
Uh-huh.
I'm one of the people who, for the last 20 years or so, has been saying at almost every conference, this is the year of robotics, and we're finally going to break through, and that robots will be on in every home and every factory. But now I really begin to believe it. One of the dramatic changes in the last few years has been the success of what we sometimes call service robots, like the Roomba vacuum cleaner. You may have seen this thing advertised. It's manufactured by a company called iRobot in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
The remarkable thing about this machine is that 2 million of them have been sold in the last 2 years. When a product sells in the millions, you can realize that it's actually beginning to penetrate.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that a robot vacuum cleaner has turned out to be one of the first really killer applications of robots.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, developments in humanoid robots, these are robots which in some sense appear or mimic human behavior and activities and appearance, have been very successful as research devices in Japan. And in Korea as well, and we're still searching for the right applications for these devices.
Right. George, I know that you had participated in a recent international R&D assessment of robotics. Can you talk about some of the important findings worldwide, and then as they specifically relate to the U.S.?
Okay. So one of the things that we discovered in traveling around the world, I headed a team of six roboticists. We were supported by the National Science Foundation and by NASA. We visited about 50 laboratories in Japan, Korea, and Western Europe. So I can summarize in the following way. First of all, there's an enormous interest in robotics these days. And it's evident to most countries except the United States that robotics could very well be the engine of major economic growth in the future. It's clearly called that in Korea, by the way. Korea has 10 national programs, which they call the engines of growth programs, and robotics is one of them. And so they invest $80 million a year in robotics research and development.
Hmm.
By contrast, the National Science Foundation in the United States invests $3 million a year.
Right.
Now, our total spending in robotics in this country, of course, is much larger, but the major fraction of it goes to military robots rather than robots for the civilian economy. So so let me quickly summarize what some of the developments are. I mentioned humanoids before. The Japanese and now the Koreans to a large extent have built a substantial number of human-appearing robots in various sizes, all the way from maybe a foot or 18 inches tall to full human height. And these things have truly remarkable abilities in terms of relating to human beings, of being able to walk up and down stairs, sitting down, lying down, carrying on conversations, and so on. On the other hand, We've done a great deal in the development of some of the software and the artificial intelligence for such machines in this country, but we basically don't build them because we have no market for them, at least at this point.
Mm-hmm.
In robotic vehicles, the Europeans have been very strong in the development of vehicles which could ultimately be autonomous vehicles traveling on highways. We had such programs in the past, but they've pretty well vanished. And these things are quite strong in Europe. I think in Japan, Korea, and in Europe, robotics research involves very close collaboration of government, industry, and academia.
Mm-hmm.
And we have relatively little such collaboration here. The government agencies give grants to universities. They seldom give such grants to industry. This is called corporate welfare in this country, and it's frowned upon.
Mm-hmm.
It's done in a number of ways, but it's not done directly in the way in which it's done in Europe. And so the kind of collaborations that enable a direct path from university research to prototype development and then commercialization, those are difficult to find in the United States.
George, thank you. Yes, no, that's great. Sam, please.
Yes, George, I'm wondering if you could comment from an overview standpoint on the importance and role in terms of applied robotics for this emerging area of artificial intelligence and heuristics and sort of advanced math and its integration with some of the chipsets we have so that you can have small packaging and manageable power issues and still have, you know, tremendous thinking power, if you will, and learning power in the robot itself.
Well, I mean, we certainly are the beneficiaries of Moore's Law, right? So that we're packing more and more computation into smaller and smaller packages and getting higher speed in the process. So that contemporary small robots have incredible computing power on board. And this enables them to perform at least a certain amount of reasoning as they move about the world. One of the hot areas of research in all countries involved in robotics is the issue of learning, because it's becoming increasingly clear that there's no way we can pre-program our robots to perform all the actions we'd like them to do in a world which is unpredictable.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so learning becomes increasingly important, and learning, as you know, is a major issue in artificial intelligence. So more and more, I think our robots are trained to perform certain actions in one environment, and then they learn how to do the same thing in a different environment, where perhaps the ground is not smooth or obstacles are unpredictable and so on.
And is that coming along satisfactorily? I was kind of wanting you to comment on whether it's okay, it's great, it's extremely promising, we're making leaps and bounds. Where is all that currently, what's the status of that currently in terms of heuristics and learning, you know, the robots learning?
Well, I would say it's still largely in the laboratory stage.
Okay.
We certainly have very successful learning robots in university laboratories. We don't have them yet in production and out in the marketplace. I think, you know, there are some exceptions to this, and the very fact that that we have robots now equipped with the ability to recognize gestures and speech, for example, in communication, those are outgrowths of the kind of programs you described.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think the ability to learn from scratch is still largely a research enterprise. So several people, including our own laboratory at USC, we built, for example, four-legged robots and didn't program the leg sequence. They learned how to move their legs. So,
That's pretty cool.
Huh. Well, actually, it is pretty cool.
Did the machines, the robots actually figure it out over time?
Well, with six legs, they did extremely well. What happened after we used evolutionary algorithms, which I view as another branch of AI, and these guys, after maybe 40 generations or so, learned how to move quite well in a gate called a wave gate, where the front two legs move and then the middle two legs and the rear two legs.
Wow.
But then we let them evolve somewhat longer, and then they developed a tripod gate, which is used by most insects,
mm-hmm.
Where they move at the same time the front and rear legs on one side and the center leg on the other side. This way they have a tripod on the ground, three legs rather than four, and they move much faster.
George, thank you. Well, we've talked about discrepancies between funding for robotics in the U.S. versus Japan, Korea, and the EU, and we've spoken many times on Science and Society about how the U.S. is severely losing leadership in science and math education, for example. Can you speak to U.S. leadership in robotics and where we're going?
Well, that obviously is a subject near and dear to my heart, and it concerns me greatly. I think that in one of the things that's been a strength in the United States is the fact that we don't have central planning in areas of technology like robotics, and therefore different laboratories can come up with different approaches to problems. But that only works when the funding levels are adequate. Mm-hmm. And now, with the kind of funding environment that we have, it's becoming extremely difficult to do so. So we now have an extremely competitive environment for research. I remember when I started many years ago in robotics and I would apply for a grant to the National Science Foundation, the probability of success was maybe 1 in 5. Now it's frequently 1 in 100. And so this means that 99 proposals are rejected out of 100 that are submitted. And this results in enormous waste of resources because people are constantly writing proposals and a tremendous amount of underfunding, therefore, in what we need to do. So I think that we are we're losing in two ways. One way is because the level of research funding is now inadequate in the United States. Not only from the National Science Foundation, but also from the military agencies. Traditionally, DARPA, the Defense Advanced Projects Agency, has supported a significant amount of work at universities, and they've done it in largely blue-sky, long-range projects. So they would frequently say that we're not interested in evolutionary change, we want revolutionary change. Now, funding from DARPA for universities in the last 2 years has probably dropped to 20 or 30% of what it was.
Oh my gosh!
A dramatic, dramatic change.
Let me follow on that. I have some concerns there because I thought, and this is quite interesting to me, what you've just revealed. But I thought that the general program for the military was to remove personnel from quote the frontline dangerous jobs and replace them more with highly intelligent robots, and obviously specialized ones like bomb disposal robots, but
right.
more and beyond that, actually fulfilling some of the functions that troops currently do. I thought that was a big deal for them.
Well, it is. It is.
But that isn't what you just said.
No. But what I said was that research and development has been cut way down.
Well, you can't cut research by two-thirds.
Well, at universities, that's right. And the programs that DARPA supports, which are very large and have been growing, are for the development of military robots, and those programs are frequently very short range. The funding is for 6 months to a year. And so you can't really do long-range research on short-term funding, you see.
No.
So, but that does not mean that we're not doing just exactly what you said. I mean, there's increasingly autonomous ground vehicles, flying vehicles, and underwater vehicles are being developed for the military in large numbers.
Well, I forgive me for saying this, but it sounds like you need to go to DARPA and stand on somebody's desk and yell at them.
Well, what is it
they don't understand, you know?
Well, what's happened is that there is we're in a financial environment where, as you know, the government is currently looking for all kinds of ways of cutting back funding on all programs which are not required. And between the war in Iraq and the disasters in New Orleans, an enormous amount of money is going to those kinds of things.
George, you were going to give us a second way.
Yeah. So this, in addition to the research, the second problem that we're facing now is that we basically no longer manufacture robots in the United States. We outsource them to China primarily, as well as other countries. even the Roomba vacuum cleaner robot is made in China based on a design in the United States. So the issue now of how to obtain venture capital for starting new companies to manufacture robots has become an extremely difficult one in the present environment.
George, thank you. We've got about 2 minutes left.
Oh, that's all! My goodness, how did it go so fast?
I know it goes. It goes so fast. could you give us quickly? I mean, certainly we want to bring you back, but could you quickly give us, you know, a couple of things, a couple of action steps for U.S. government and universities?
Well, I mean, I think it's important to raise the level of consciousness, not only in robotics but in other areas of technology, where in the United States we're beginning to see that we're losing ground to other countries. We have to be extremely careful not to lose the major strength of our universities and research institutions. We built, after the Second World War, an enormously successful research and educational establishment. And my great concern is that we could lose that leadership in the next few years.
Mm-hmm.
And let me just add one final thing, if I may, and that is we're moving into a period where this additional intelligence in robots will also lead to increasingly interesting interactions between humans and robots.
Mm-hmm.
I think you realize this. As we add complexity, the behavior of the machines we build will become to some extent unpredictable, and we'll see emergent behaviors of various kinds. So the potential for interesting relationships between humans and robots and their ability to help us in a large number of tasks, not only in the home but in factories and, as you say, in the military, these possibilities will continue to grow.
George, thank you. Well, that's exactly what we'd love to talk about if we're able to schedule a follow-up with you.
Yes, indeed. We certainly would, sir.
I would be certainly delighted anytime.
George, thank you for making time for us. Our guest is Dr. George Becky, Gordon Marshall Professor of Computer Science, Electrical Engineering, and Biomedical Engineering at the University of Southern California. Stay with us on Science and Society.